Hi everyone, Ian Gardner here. We have another Innovation Bay news podcast for you right now. We do this every 3 weeks. Can't believe it's been 3 weeks since the last one. Used to be fortnightly, never done monthly. I don't think there's a word for every 3 weeks, but that is our cadence. Fantastic panel on the show. We've got Andrea Kowalski, who is a general partner with Tidal Ventures, which is an Australian-based venture fund, seed stage. She's actually based in New York, so it brings some pretty interesting insight from her perspective. And yeah, we go into a little bit about how Tidal's viewing the world. And Matt Allen. So Matt and I used to work together at AWS. He's been a developer, he's been a recruiter, but he's now running Tractor Ventures, which is a great company that he's been in the show, the actual main podcast, within the last year. So you can go and revisit that. And Matt gives us a bit of an update. Look, loads of great news once again. It's just, we seem to be deluged with good news. Didn't get through as much as we wanted. We were a little bit time constrained this morning. Andrea being in New York had a sort of late finish or a late start there, or an early start for us, late for her. So yeah, let's jump over and hear from the panel. All right, welcome. This is Innovation Bay's podcast, and it is our news show. We're coming to you. It is Freedom Day in New South Wales. It is 8 a.m. or 8:20 on the 11th of October. We're doing an early start because we have a guest from New York. So Andrea Kowalski is partner at Tidal Ventures. Welcome, Andrea.
Thanks very much, Ian. Happy to be here.
Yeah, great. And a man that we all know and all know well, Matt Allen, all the way from Melbourne.
Hey.
How are you,
good
Matt?
Night. Good morning.
Yeah, Matt is with Tractor Ventures and still in lockdown, unfortunately. So I probably shouldn't be banging on too much about our Freedom Day here.
Soon.
It's coming. I've already been in the squash court. I'm doing it all. Played squash this morning because that wasn't allowed. Although I can't imagine an activity more guaranteed to give you COVID if you're playing with someone that's also got COVID. and then we're going to the cinema tonight. So, and then a restaurant tomorrow. All right. Yeah, Matt's shaking his head. Is that enough?
Stop now.
I'm very impressed with your planning. You're like, doors open, boom, here we go.
Well, yeah, maybe. It's been a long time coming. Anyway, it's like for all our Melbourne friends out there, hang in there. We will get there. And for all my Sydney friends, let's catch up and have a coffee. All right. Well, look, once again, we have another, it's a massive news. The cycle that we've been doing is sort of 3 weeks rather than two. And our run sheet runs to about 30 items. So we tried to prioritize them somewhat and get to people who can talk to it. Let's maybe start with the Global Startup Genome Report. A couple of interesting snippets in there. Sydney has gone up a few places. I mean, again, I'm a bit skeptical as to how they rank all these, but Sydney is apparently 24th in the world. And Melbourne, I don't have it in front of me, but I think it was 35th, Matt. Can you remember?
Not off the top of my head.
I think it was tied for 36, actually.
All right, so it's in the 30s. I mean, look, these are good, because it certainly feels having feet in the ground here that we are doing well. New York, as Andrea will know, is tied for second place.
Yep.
London has rocketed up, so Silicon Valley is number one. But when you actually look at the report, you had the same scores as Silicon Valley and slightly more than London. So I don't understand how you came joint second. But yeah, Andrea, any observations on this? Like, part of the reason I was keen to have you on is because you have your foot in both camps. Like, you're a partner at an Australian VC firm deploying Australian money, but you live in New York. So what are you seeing from your world?
Well, I might even just go back in time for 6 years because I was working in venture in Berlin prior to going to Sydney, which is prior to coming to New York. And when I read the report for 2021, I just kind of dug into the archives of 2015, which is the year that I moved to Sydney. And interestingly, Berlin, where I was coming from, was ranked number 9 in the world, and Sydney was ranked number 16. Now, there's obviously been like a huge proliferation of other ecosystems that have accelerated and kind of built up competition. But what I thought was interesting is Berlin now is 22 and Sydney's 24. So that gap is really narrowing. And I was just trying to think about why that's happening. And I think one of the really unique things about Australia is that the kind of geographical isolation actually means that funds that are raising are a lot more focused and dedicated on that region, whereas the likes of Berlin is going to compete with funds that are European wide. You often have far fewer funds that are specifically, Paris or Berlin or Vienna, etc. It's very much European. So I think that's actually a huge contributor. Is if you actually kind of map the funds under management within Australia to our ranking globally. I think that kind of focus of capital in the Australian market has been really, really helpful because it's actually concentrate investment into the region. And one thing that Sydney ranked really well on was talent, which I think is another thing that Australia is known for, is having this like really tight-knit, product-centric engineering background market. Still a bit expensive compared to other regions, but very strong and very appealing. And that's something that I think New York has also, not even improved on, but continued to do very well on in the last 5 or 6 years, is building up like a real hub of talent.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear a little more about how it's actually working for you. I mean, like you are a partner, general partner with Tidal, which is an Australian firm, Grant McCarthy and Wendell Kuhneman as well.
Yep.
But you're in New York, so how is that working?
Well, excellent. First and foremost.
There's definitely a thesis behind it, so tell us about that.
I'm a night owl, so that's a good start. Yeah, so the thesis is that the market has changed dramatically over that 5 to 6 year period since I've been in Australia, where Australian companies can go straight to the US for a Series A time and time again, where I think 5 or 6 years ago, you had a very different kind of set of thresholds as an Australian company that you needed to surpass. You needed to be kind of 10 million of ARR, 25% of your revenue from the US, key executives on the ground, potentially flip up from a legal perspective, and ideally at least one founder in the market. Now, some of these things still happen with Australian companies, but the point is you don't need to demonstrate that in order to raise from the US. I think the market is a lot more global. And so I actually moved to US when I was with Bailador, because I was working with a lot of our kind of late Series A, early Series B companies in the US. But the thesis now stands for seed. So we work really closely with seed companies in Australia. We help move them through that seed to Series A sprint. And then help kind of expand from a go-to-market perspective, setting them up for investment. And, you know, I very much act as that kind of eyes and ears on the ground in the US and kind of collaborate with our founders, but also our founders who have moved over to the US. I mean, we're in similar time zones. So the ability to just, you know, jump on a huddle or Zoom or whatever medium you want to use, particularly through remote work, just allows that kind of more constant real-time collaboration. And someone who really understands the market, whereas a lot of Australian founders that are coming over, they're having to learn about the market while they expand into the market, which can be quite confusing. That's kind of the thesis.
And Matt, I love it. Matt, yeah, keen to hear your thoughts in this startup genome report. I mean, the whole Melbourne versus Sydney thing and versus global, does it matter?
Look, I don't think it does matter. I'd rather see us all operate as one, you know, as one thing. You know, the only people that think about Australian territories are people that are inside them. I think that it's interesting that a lot of this growth comes from outliers, right? You know, you throw the air wallets and Canvas and so forth, and it's kind of throw these things around a lot. So it'll be good to see when this growth comes from not a few outliers, but actually a larger cohort of bigger companies as well. As far as touching on the talent stuff, I think the biggest risk we have for all our early portfolios, and all three of us are involved in early stage venture, is that the big guys are here throwing money at people, especially for engineering talent. You know, when Square makes an offer to an engineer, it's a lot. Like it's a lot. You know, it's liquid RSUs. There's all kinds of things that change the way that the talent make decisions as to where they go. So I think that on the other side of that, there's more and more people that have seen actual results from actual ESOP. So, you know, I think as the ecosystem grows, as the waves come out of the Atlassians, you know, the Canvas, the large scale ups that get liquidity, which start new startups and have experience and only be able to do that because they've had success in another one, it just feels, I think we need to remind ourselves that Blackbird Fund 1 isn't even 10 years old yet. So as far as cycles go, like we're not doing too bad for being 80% of the way through the first fund's life cycle. That's kind of how I see it.
No, I think I completely agree with you. I was chatting to someone else about this a minute. You know, our relativity versus the rest of the world and how the ecosystem's doing is kind of immaterial, because the reality is we are here and we need to make the best of what we've got, and we need to focus everything we've got on making it as good as possible. And, you know, and that's part of the reason that, you know, I run Innovation Bay and do this podcast. I mean, it's hopefully just spreading the gospel that there is something in these startups and it can be fun and you can make some good money and you can change the world. I mean, these are things that we should be
doubling down on, which I think we're all doing. So, all right, let's maybe talk about a few more things. And Matt, I do want to hear a bit more about Tractor. So maybe this first story, we can use that as a bit of a segue. So Clearco is coming into the e-commerce boom with a data-driven pitch. So yeah, why don't you touch on this and then tell us what Tractor's up to?
Sure. So, you know, Clearco is one of the larger alternative finance companies. So, you know, there's up until recently, the way that founders, you know, get capital into the companies to sell shares to other investors. And I think as companies grow, selling shares forever is probably not the best way to scale your business. So, you know, Clear is a revenue-based finance company. It uses algorithms to determine whether or not your startup can pull some of your revenue forward is the best way to think about these things. It uses AI. And Tractor, we do a very similar thing. So these guys are very focused on sort of allowing you to spend your money on ads, basically. You know, their AI says the more you spend on ads, the more product you drive, the more revenue you sell, the faster you go, which is a nice touch.
And that's the e-commerce focus. I mean, the reality is with e-commerce, you have more data to be able to pull the levers on. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, like you should be able to draw some lines between CAC and LTV and gross margins and all these are things. And, you know, it's funny that we're talking about these things in startup land now, like they're something new and special. In reality, every other company in the world for as long as they've existed has not sold shares to other parties to grow their companies. They've taken loans. Now, you know, revenue-based finance is technically not a loan, but it is pulling forward things and you don't have to pay it back. You know, other things like PIPE, you know, talk about securitization. If you ever hear the word securitization and you're like, I wonder what that is, the answer is it's a loan. You still have to pay this money back, and you're going to pay it back with, you know, whether it be a fixed fee or whether it be an interest rate is neither here nor there. The point being is that you're not selling equity. That's the entire point. So, you know, we welcome it, you know, PIPE, Lighter, Clear, Tractor, you know, we're all here to help founders grow their businesses without having to necessarily sell their shares or necessarily sell them right now. And really what we're talking about here is deferral of equity. So it might be that if you can use mechanisms like this to grow your business faster, then when you do bring in some equity partners down the line, you can do it at a better valuation. You can sell fewer shares, retain more for the founder to put the actual hard work in.
Tell us a bit more about Tractor, because you guys have been on a tear. I think you were on the podcast with me, what, a year?
Yeah.
Is it just over a year?
Under a year.
Oh, my God. We did it in person, so I remember that.
There you go.
I do remember exactly where I was, but I can never remember the dates. But yeah, look, you seem to be hiring a lot. You're handing out loans. You're raising funds.
Yep.
You're also actually the only person who is a member of three of innovation-based communities. So you started in Horizon, which is our angel investor community. You're very active there. And then you've also joined Aurora, which is our venture community, and now Summit, because you're also a startup.
Exactly right.
Which is our late stage founder community. So
yeah, so you can thank me for being your biggest customer later.
That's right. Thank you. That's where you're on.
Like Tractors, we started with a hypothesis. We everything we do is an experiment. We wanted to figure out whether or not founders were ready to take this non-dilutive capital. Clear talks about using AI. I think what's really important to think about here is, any capital you take into your business, it's really important to understand who's on the other side of it. You know, as VCs, it's like we want people to, our capital becomes commoditized and you end up choosing the people you want to work with. It's the same with debt, it's the same with RBF. You want to make sure that the people are there. So, you know, our theory was there's a bunch of founders building companies who are either not taking venture or do take venture and they're not ready to do another round yet. That would be interesting taking some different types of capital. Turns out there is. So we did a small round. We launched December last year. We've just closed another big one, and we're about to stand up our very first debt warehouse, which is effectively a fund. It's the same as VCs do. You start a fund. The fund instead of taking equity, they expect a debt return. We deploy that capital and we go again. So hopefully by the end of the year, we'll have some interesting stuff to announce. When it comes to scale, we will have it. We're also doing things with a bunch of automation and a bunch of data analysis to understand the shape of businesses. I think in reality, what it'll come down to is our ability to understand and risk score growing tech businesses, which the banks just can't do. So, you know, the way we see it, like we don't really compete with banks. You know, what we compete against is expensive equity.
Yeah, got it. All right. Well, look, thank you. Let's keep rolling. We've probably got 25 minutes and got a lot of news to get through. So, Andrea, this is definitely in your sweet spot because it is about Tidal. And there was an announcement in Startup Daily, I think last week, that you're basically trying to build, you know, leverage the network, you know, and this really resonated with me, you know, like with Gelix, we've got 125 LPs right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no dentist from Parramatta. You know, and you know, with all respect to dentists from Parramatta, they probably can't help much with leaning
in. The international go-to-market.
Yeah, no, they've got money, but they don't have any expertise. So the ability to leverage that expertise for the benefit of your portfolio, I think, is what this was all about. So it really resonated for me. So I'd love to hear a bit more about this and what it's all about.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're really excited about this. You know, the catalyst for establishing this network was actually to completely disintermediate ourselves as investors. So basically to remove anything that stands between kind of our founders and our collective networks. I think one of the challenges that we've seen over our venture careers is that there's a lot of value in the networks that we have individually and collectively. And there is this friction point where founders kind of need to first identify maybe a challenge or an area where they need a little bit of help. And then they'll reach out and they'll speak to you and you'll think, oh, you know, I probably have someone who you should chat to who's gone through a similar problem, who can share their experience. But then I have to email that person. And what if I email that person the week before? You know, has there been enough space between the favors I've asked? And then they meet for coffee and it's like, oh, this has been really awesome. You know, thank you so much. And then it's a bit of like, oh, okay, cool. And nice to meet you. And it's kind of like, where do you go from there? So that's kind of the starting point when we were trying to think about what are some of the areas that aren't, they're not broken within venture, but maybe they're not as good as they could be. And I think to really understand the impetus behind 10, which is hashtag 10, Tidal Expert Network, you really have to understand the extent to which we eat our own dog food. Am I getting that right? I'm always getting expressions wrong, but we eat our own dog food, and that we're very focused on companies that are building first-class products and capabilities around product-led growth. And so we're trying to do the same thing. And so every time someone identifies a capability in Tidal, it's like, okay, how can we productize this? And so the idea between 10, again, to disintermediate ourselves, is to bring this vetted network to identify how they want to work with founders, you know, based on the availability, based on their core competencies, and to basically just allow our founders to access that network without needing to go through us to search expertise. You know, it could be within the very narrow aspect of product management or within engineering or a global go-to-market, and then to see those individuals, how are they available? Are they willing to do workshops? Are they willing to, you know, drop in for 2 days a week for 6 months and help set up a new function? Will they kind of act as like my mentor and advisor as I get to my next stage? And so that's all very upfront and clear to our founders. And then I think that the second aspect of what we're trying to do is really to mirror or leverage the global support that we offer our portfolio, with myself being in the US. So to make this network as global as it can be and as diverse as it can be around operational and geographical capabilities. And
how are you actually doing it? Is it a WhatsApp group or Slack, or you got your own software? I mean, what is it like?
So at the moment, V1, our MVP, is both in Slack and Notion.
Right.
So we have public facing Notion pages, and we have closed Notion pages by invite only, that basically acts as a bit of a database. And it's also an area for our members to showcase some of their experience if that's helpful. And again, it really depends. Sometimes they just want to sit on boards. They want to angel invest. They don't have a lot of time, you know, at this point in their career, but maybe they will in 6 months. So we kind of will update the surveys to capture their preferences and stuff. And so we're trying our best, like I said, to basically wrap product mentality around this network of investors that are already supportive of Tidal and the portfolio and really excited by what our founders are doing. And the really interesting thing is a lot of the drive from our network is just wanting to give back in ways that they benefited when they were themselves founders or executives in any of big companies. So again, it's trying to make that frictionless to the extent that we can.
No, it makes a lot of sense. And that, you know, give back and legacy and, you know, the ability to offer up expertise. I mean, that was one of the drivers we found when we were signing up LPs to our fund.
Definitely.
And Matt, you were nodding a lot when you were listening to that. I mean, this, I mean, like, and you've been StartMate's number one ranked mentor. I mean, like, you are notorious for being great with founders. And so what's your view on this and how investors, even at arm's length, can add value?
Yeah, I think there's almost kept following on from our, you know, the talent thing we were talking about before is, you know, think about Tidal. We think about Attractor as well. Attractor have 70 investors, so they're shareholders rather than LPs, but they're all founders and ex-founders and family offices. So they're all there with the right intent. And G-Lix too. You know, and it might even roll into our next story we're about to talk about is, I think, you know, VCs or investors who were ex-founders who have been through the ringer, who attract ex-founders, who there's this phase at the moment where there's a bunch of, as Andrew said, founders who want to give back, who actually have time, some time, no capital or some capital and some time, and sort of figuring out where they sit on that matrix and that sort of, you know, two-axis grid is really important. That's kind of the job. It's almost like that's the job I see us having to do for our founders is, and then, you know, Andrew unlocking it with the ability to not have to gatekeep it is kind of an interesting thing, right? How do you scale a small capital allocation team?
Yeah, exactly.
So when you've got a very large set of excited yet busy and LPs or investors, it's the ultimate challenge, isn't it? Without throwing people at it to try and hold context of everything that's going on at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, Matt, you alluded to this before. So Black Nova is a new Sydney VC fund. I mean, they've been around for a little while. Matt Brown is the guy behind it. He came out of Dunsafe.
Yep.
That's right. And Matt, so like you know Matt well, and you've got some insight in this. So tell us about what you know about Black Nova, Matt.
Yeah. So Black Nova is Matt Brown and Darcy Norton. So Matt was my co-founder, one of my two co-founders at Dunsafe, and they sold that company in the beginning of 2020. And the first thing he did was declare that he's going to put half of his returns back into early stage venture, which he's been doing personally. So he's been personally writing these investments with a mechanism that allows him to flip them up into the fund when they come along. So in parallel with that, we've been raising the fund. So you know, Matt's an investor in Tractor. I'm a venture partner at Black Nova. So I can separate my equity conversations and my debt conversations and not be conflicted. And it's working really well. So interesting model they've taken there, which is there's two general partners and six, I think, venture partners who are all ex-founders as well. So similar model. Like what's the best way to help a founder is go, oh, you know, I feel your pain. I actually feel your pain because it was only a short period of time ago since I was there myself. Let me help. And then aligning incentives, right? You know, you align incentives by, especially in the venture partner thing is sharing carry and sharing upside. We're all LPs in the fund as well. So there's extra incentive alignment there. And I just think this is going to happen more, you know, it doesn't necessarily even take a large exit for a founder to come back and start doing this stuff again. Although Dunsafe pretty, it was. The other thing there to note is, the other general partner is Darcy Norton, which is also, he's also the chair of Tractor and one of my, helped me architect the model we use. So there's an interesting, loop of people working with people they trust. Like, you know, first time founders, first time investors, everybody doing it for the first time. And all of a sudden you're doing it for the second or third time. And the observation we're making is that when you're doing stuff for the second and third time, shit goes faster and it gets a hell of a lot easier when you don't have to learn stuff from scratch.
And it's worth noting that, I mean, the debt stuff you're doing is not necessarily mutually exclusive to the venture stuff.
Not at all.
I've been helping lighter capital out here as well. And, you know, I can do that hand on heart with my G-Lix responsibilities. So, you know, the two, you know, 1 + 1 = 3. All right, Andrea, like keen to hear a bit more from you. So like, there is a story here. You both made an investment in Airrobe, I believe, which came out of StartMate. And there's a story in the AFR last week about the Iconic teaming up with Airrobe so that when you buy a piece of clothing on the Iconic, you can immediately post it on Airrobe, which is kind of like the secondhand or not secondhand, but it's a
circular economy.
It's a peer-to-peer marketplace, yeah, and secondhand
yeah,
items.
Let me throw it to you and tell us about this and why you're so excited by this announcement.
Well, where to start? Well, first of all, I invested with Matt, what was it, a year ago, 10 months ago, around there, as an angel. So that's the first thing to disclose. And then it was brought by our principal, Georgie, to investment committee from a title perspective just a month or two ago. So just to kind of give you the lay of the involvement.
No, and that's pretty common. Like a lot of GPs do invest as angels.
Yeah. I mean, Hannon, it was a bunch of wireframes a year ago.
Hannon's the CEO.
Yes. And so it's a little bit early for title, but it just fit like smack in the middle of sustainability and commerce enablement thematics. And I was really impressed with her and I loved her vision. So that's why I went in on a PA basis. But so I'll start to try to, by framing Arrove and kind of what it is, and then talking a little bit about why I get so excited, and then obviously Matt, jump in, because you probably share perspectives on why you're excited. So the cool thing about Arrove is it's not just that peer-to-peer secondhand marketplace. It's kind of what I see as like an end-to-end solution for the peer-to-peer circular economy. And so it starts on one end of the spectrum by unlocking supply at scale, and it engages with the merchant. And I'm going to define merchant as like a brand and a retailer, like the Iconic, that is a retailer in this example. And so at Title, we're always asking our founders, like right at the beginning of the investment process, you know, what is your product currency? And so like, what is that penny drop aspect of what you do that drives really clear value for your customers? So let's start with that merchant, that brand, or that retailer as a customer. And what does Arrove do? Well, there's a plugin that goes in at the checkout of the e-commerce brand or retailer. And it basically asks consumers to add items to their digital wardrobe, their Arrove at the end of the day. So first of all, it's just capturing all the metadata and information around that purchase and the content, imagery, et cetera, and it's storing it visually for the consumer to see. But the currency it's driving for the merchant is that Arrove has introduced something that's considered the total cost of ownership. So if I'm going to buy a dress on Scanlon and Theodore, just trying to think of an Australian brand really quick, for $800, I can see at the time of checkout that I can sell that dress most likely for around $550. So all of a sudden I'm thinking, oh, in the end, this dress is going to cost me $250, not $800. So if you think of the psychology of buy now, pay later, you know, the checkout conversion tends to increase when a buy now, pay later plugin is installed, because consumers are thinking, oh, it's not as big of an outlay up front, and I can delay it over four weeks typically. With Arrove, it's very different in that there's a larger outlay up front, but you're starting to think over the life of when you own the item that it's not going to cost you as much as that initial ticket price. And so you tend to see like increase in average order value and increase just generally in conversion. So merchants love that, because as we all know, e-commerce is like a super competitive, margins driven business. But the more important thing that Arrove does, which feeds right into the sustainability thematic, is that, I mean, I've got some stats that I recall even just from putting this together a few months ago. The reused fashion market is expected to grow to 76 US billion by 2024. And millennials and Gen Z, or Gen Z, sorry, are expected to spend 5 times more on the secondhand marketplace in the coming years. And these are the really big opportunities for merchants, like this segment of the population. And so brands actually don't have a choice, in my opinion, around needing to be sustainable. They need to be using more sustainable materials. They need to accept that the secondary market is a big part of fashion going forward. And they need to find a way, not just to market, but to actually enable and play in that space. And a lot of brands at the moment are struggling to prioritize and figure out, do I want to own my own e-commerce site? Oh, is that going to cannibalize my primary market? How do the two intertwine? So what Arrove allows these merchants and these brands to do is basically participate from day one with a seamless plugin that allows them to propel the secondary market and build up the supply for the brand and bring it through to secondary sale or purchase. So I just love the fact that in a very sustainable way, literally and figuratively, Arrove is kind of driving the same impact of a buy now, pay later product. But it's not just a financing mechanism. It's actually a sustainable reduction in ownership costs that then fuels the secondary market that we know is just going to be massive in the coming years. So that's a lot. I hope that explained it.
That's great. And it's better than chucking your old clothes into the landfill. I mean, that's part of the problem that we're trying to solve here.
Like huge.
The amount of cotton that's, you know, there's a lot of energy and water and all that other stuff that goes into cotton. And it's not great for the planet when you chuck it away.
And there's a huge issue as well where, between different countries. So, I mean, there's articles where you can see the incredible like ships filled of textile from old clothing shipped off to third world countries, of which a portion of it is actually sold and used for commerce, which is great. But it's getting to the point now where 80-90% of it is not even sellable within that country. And so now you've just taken literally your own sort of landfill issue and you've transported it to another country for them to deal with. So I think just reducing the landfill waste within more developed countries is going to have, again, a global impact. So.
Matt, we don't have a huge amount of time. If you've got any comments to make on that, you can do it. Otherwise, we'll
move on and talk. Just super quickly. I worked with Hannah during StartMate, and then made an investment and put her in front of Scale, investors, which invested in the thing, in the round. But for me, Hannah is just a quiet executor. You know, we see a lot of founders that are quite noisy. She's very quiet and just gets stuff done. You know, for a solo, non-technical founder to, you know, start and land the Iconic in a couple of months. And she's also gone to the States. She's actually just picked up and left. So, she's currently in San Francisco working on her startup, you know, left during the middle of the pandemic when you could barely leave the country. There's a lot of grit and determination and just execution, just quiet execution that I think is underrated. It's a very Aussie trait, you know, especially when you get compared to some of the US founders and even some of the noisy Australian founders in the US. I think she just gets stuff done. And as an early stage investor, you really can't ask for more.
Yeah, she's definitely going to quietly take over the world. She's that kind of person. Yeah.
Love it. I've never met her actually, but I've heard a lot of good things about her. So yeah, good on her. Great story. So well done to those guys. All right, Lawpath is next on the chopping block. So this is it's been around for a while. I'm actually a small shareholder by investing in the very first Pollinizer fund.
Yeah.
Anyone with long memories will go back there, and Pollinizer sort of incubated in some ways Lawpath. And it's been a breakout success. Dom Woolwich, who's their CEO, awesome guy. He has joined. He's part of the Summit group as well, which Innovation Bay runs. And there's an announcement. So they've just raised $7.5 million from a bunch of different people, including the Gonski family. So Michael Gonski is a partner at Herbert Strith HSF, and knows a bit. And yeah, it seems like an awesome outcome for an awesome company. Andrea, any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, so I think to your point, the company has been around for a while, which could speak to the fact that maybe they were a little bit early to market. But what they've done a remarkable job of is really figure out their sweet spot and how the intersection of technology and professional services can work together. I think, you know, the ambition of Dom to have Lawpath become the zero of law for like a founder is interesting because it pushes the question onto them around how do you think about legal? And the answer is often infrequently and with trepidation. So either you need to comply or you have a problem. Where I think what the change of behavior that's being facilitated with Lawpath is that, you know, the legal aspect of a founder's journey comes in commercial contracts, you know, filing for tax records. Like there's so many different aspects of that journey that you can just access with more tech-enabled service. So I don't think that the market's ready for professional services to be replaced with technology overnight. But I think that, you know, I speak a lot to the workflow automation thematic, and we're actually working on a company, Confidential, on an investment within the workflow automation sector within legal. And I think what's really interesting that Lawpath's speaking to as well is that you have this division between the really high value services that are at a high cost. And then you've got they're not low value, they're critical, but they're not as expert driven, but they're still at a high cost because it's often the same people that are providing the service. So like, how do you democratize the tail of legal services that don't require like a super special international tax lawyer that understands, you know, this, that, and the other. And so to actually automate some of the components at that lower end to then leverage the time of the professional services provider, I think it's brilliant. And that's exactly where the market is heading. So I think this is actually, I don't know if it's quite pivotal, but LawPath actually nailing the sweet spot and raising this round and actually succeeding with the subscription model is basically saying, like, there is a huge subset of the legal sector that we can fully underpin and support before you have to get to that, in my example, like international tax specialist. So I think it's really cool.
And there's definitely some disruption coming through in that legal sector, legal automation. Jellicks invested in Joseph.
Exactly. Another,
business. I mean, they've done super well. Went on, raised a Series A last year. I don't know, maybe it was earlier this year.
Yeah, I think it was earlier this year. Time, exactly.
Yeah, time has stopped for us. So anyway, but yes, there is some good stuff happening in Australia around that sector.
Yeah, and I think hopefully we'll have a third announcement soon. And so that's three in the last 6 months, which again speaks to market timing, which is exciting. Yeah.
Yep. All right, look, tragically, we're in 5 minutes and Matt's got some new starters today and has to go and induct them in 5 minutes. So let's keep rolling. Glow Capital Partners, let's talk about that. So Kate Morris, and who's from Adore Beauty fame, and Justin Ryan have launched a new private equity venture. Matt, I think you know Kate pretty well. Yep. You can explain why. I sometimes wonder, like, Kate is still the CEO at Adore Beauty. So has she not got a job?
No, she's not the CEO. She has a CEO. So she's the chief innovation officer, I think, at Adore.
Therefore, she has a bit more time.
So she has more time. So Kate and Justin are also shareholders at Tractor, which is very lovely to have people like that in our court. The thing that most excites me about this is the story that Kate tells about, you know, doing the roadshow for the IPO for Adore, and just, you know, the lack of diversity in the top end of equity town, globally, in Australia, but also globally. So, you know, they're not a VC. You know, they're not going for volume here. They'll probably do two or three chunky $20 million plus investments a year. But they are sort of focusing on e-commerce. Makes sense. It's a strong suite. Focusing on, growth in e-commerce. I think there's an interesting subset of the PE market opening up in Australia, which is kind of that growth capital. It's almost capital, you know, it's still founders running their businesses. It's not the traditional PE come in and take 51%, you know, and flip it in 2 years' time. But it's also not for companies that necessarily have to do multiple rounds of capital going forwards. You know, there's this sort of, it's almost, you know, it aligns quite well the stuff some of the Tractor founders do as well. It's like, you don't need to continually be on this race trail to build an amazing business. But again, back to the things we spoke about with all our respective funds earlier, it's the people on the end of the capital are really, really, really important. So picking the people that you like, that have experience and that have empathy for you, I think is important. So I don't know if there's any more likable people than Justin and Kate when it comes to the private equity.
It's interesting. I mean, I don't know too much about it, but it's interesting that they have tagged it as private equity rather than venture. Any insights in that?
I think it's that whole, like, you know, it's that whole, we're here for 18 months before you have to go again. You know, private equity is kind of, here's your capital, let's build the business off the back of it type thing. The different, you know, the edges are fuzzy around the mechanics, but ultimately VCs is usually, there'll be lots more of this stuff and then there'll be a big event. Where a lot of these businesses, can do with one chunk of big capital and don't necessarily need to keep doing it. I think that's the difference.
Yeah, if I could chime in from a US perspective, that's exactly right, Matt. Is, you know, growth equity is like a subsector of venture / PE. It's huge in the US. It's really established. You have a lot of funds where they are driving their returns. You know, 80% of those returns are coming from growth. So this is not your typical PE. Optimize the cost base and find some savings. This is like, go get the market. But a lot of these companies, and I can think of, you know, Spectrum Equity, Insight Partners, Level Equity, these are just three that I've worked with recently that come to mind, and they're all invested in Australian companies, but they are looking at, here's a ticket of capital to Matt's point, and we'll have an exit in 3 to 5 years. Not, we're going to run really hard and raise again in 6 months or 12 months, which is what's happening in the US at the moment. So I think it's really cool with Glow Capital. It's almost, again, a measure of the maturity in the Australian market that we're getting to this point where there's actually this capabilities piece where Kate's background is bringing a lot of firsthand experience attached to the capital piece. Whereas previously, I feel like growth equity in Australia has been largely that pre-IPO play, which isn't the same as having like an experienced operator work with the founder to drive that outcome in quote unquote 3 to 5 years. So yeah, I think it's really interesting to see that.
And it's 3 to 5x in 3 to 5 years. Like that's basically
exactly.
The 100%.
I hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, if anyone can get that, then that's a pretty good return. So that's it's not to be sniffed at. Right. I think we've maybe got time for one more before Matt has to go and induct some people. Look, and I'll lump them all together in this sort of fintech bucket. And the Global Genome Startup Report did tag Sydney as one of the most promising. I can't remember how they phrased it, but we were number one for fintech readiness. And there's four, and it's not just Sydney. I mean, Airwallex, which is a Melbourne business, is one of the stories. But just, you know, we have a capability in fintech. So first story, Airwallex cracks $5 billion valuation, just raised $275 million. Second story, which isn't really fintech, but US giant has snapped up Hyperana, which was a Sydney AI business. Third one, fintech Till Payments, just raised $110 million, which is pretty big. And then fourth story, Fund Squire just landed $75 million. So who, like, I don't know who, who's the fintech expert, but let's throw it to you, Matt, just because you're in Melbourne, and then Andrea.
Okay. It's interesting from a fintech perspective, although, you know, as you said, they're not all fintechs. It's commonly said that the regulation in Australia is pretty full on when it comes to fintech and the regulation industry. So like, if you can get it right here, it can translate elsewhere. It's not easy, but the bar's really high. So, you know, Airwallex being able to participate in here means that, you know, internationally places that are slightly more loose than Australia, they will definitely comply with. So I think that there's an interesting sort of, if you can set up to play well here, you can play globally. So I think that's really interesting. I think, you know, Airwallex have also started a $200 million investment fund, I think, plus US, you know, to invest in fintechs as well. So I don't know, like, is it just capital all the way down? I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I wasn't clear in that one either. Andrew, any insight? I mean, New York is obviously well known at a macro level for its fintech or its financial economy, but what's your insight here?
So the interesting thing with fintech in the US is that, to Matt's point, the regulatory environment that surrounds it is very different. So US fintech is a lot less centralized and a lot more startup led. So the innovation coming from kind of consumer ideas, the way that you see a lot of these larger fintech companies is really starting from the consumer, not from the regulatory position. And I think with Australia, to Matt's point, you know, with the NPP and consumer data rights, open banking, et cetera, you're seeing a lot of these companies build on top of those rails or infrastructure. And that also lends itself very well to markets like the UK. So there's that kind of direct expansion play, at least into that market initially. But then there's no reason that companies can't also expand directly into the US. So I think that having that high bar, whilst some would argue from within Australia that maybe that's a point of frustration, it has actually positioned ourselves very well at a global level in terms of meeting the requirements of many different markets. So it does mean that, you know, the TAMs are incredibly global from day one if you've gotten it right in Australia first. So I completely agree with what Matt said. Yeah.
All right. Look, Matt, we'd better let you go and deal with your new staff. So yeah, congrats. And thank you, both of you. Andrea, I know it's late there in New York.
No,
I think I'll see you there. Like, I'm coming to New York.
I am really excited. You're my first Australian visitor in a very long time.
Yeah. So. Christmas in New York. So like, hopefully the flights will open. And Matt, hopefully I get to see you before that, but I think I might get to New York before I get to Melbourne, like the way things are going. But no, I don't think that's true. I think we will open.
Good. All right. Looking forward to it.
So, all right. Thank you, guys. And thanks all for listening. And we'll see you in the next one.
Bye now.
Thanks, Ian. Have a great day, guys.